Pope Francis embarks on an apostolic visit to Indonesia while a former Vatican spokesman is accused of sexual abuse. The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal are here with analysis. Jonathan Rumi, star of the mega hit streaming series The Chosen, talks with me on set about how playing Jesus has changed his faith and career. In the post-Roe America, why is there such division in the pro-life movement as a presidential election nears? President of SBA Pro-Life America, Marjorie Dannenfelser, weighs in. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Lots to get to tonight. First, some news. Earlier this week, fire broke out in an historic church in the northern French town of Saint-Omer. The Church of the Immaculate Conception was badly damaged by an arsonist on September 2nd. No one was injured, but the church steeple and bell tower eventually collapsed. A suspect who was living in a hostel was apprehended just hours after the blaze was brought under control. An initial investigation has found that the suspect has a history of church arson attacks. In an historic act, parish priest Father Sebastian Roussel rescued the Blessed Sacrament and some 20 other religious artifacts, including the reliquary of Saint Corneille. In 2023, 27 churches were burned in France. 12 have been torched in the first 6 months of 2024. Attacks on religious monuments in recent years account for approximately 90% of the anti-Christian acts recorded annually by France's Ministry of the Interior. This is satanic. We will keep you updated on these developing events. Our friend and one of the original members of the Papal Posse, Father Roger Landry, has been appointed National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies USA. Cardinal Louis Tagle, Prefect of the Dicastery for Evangelization, formally approved the appointment. The Pontifical Mission Societies serves the Pope to support missions and young churches throughout the world. Father Landry is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and once served as attaché to the Holy See's Permanent Observer Mission at the UN. He recently was a chaplain at Columbia University in New York. Congratulations to Father Roger. And Pope Francis embarks on an apostolic visit in Indonesia this week, the longest voyage of his pontificate at 12 days. He hopes to encourage the small Catholic community there, very small, to promote interfaith harmony and dialogue in a country where the world's largest Muslim population dominates. Meanwhile, the former Vatican spokesman, or a former Vatican spokesman, faces charges of sexual abuse. With analysis of all this and more is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Thank you both for being here. Gents, I want to start with the Pope's trip to Indonesia and Oceania. This is a tiny Catholic population, only 3% of 275 million people. Arriving in Jakarta on Tuesday, Pope Francis met with Indonesian authorities in the morning, later with priests, nuns, and seminarians at Jakarta's Our Lady of the Assumption Cathedral. In his prepared remarks, the Pope celebrated Indonesia's human diversity as, quote, a magnificent mosaic, while at the same time warning that diversity can sometimes lead to conflict. Father Jerry, the Pope made a point of assuring the Indonesian president that the church is committed to interreligious dialogue. Your thoughts about that sentiment and the necessity of this trip now?
Well, the trip is good for those Catholics in that part of the world precisely because of the increasing pressure that's being felt in other parts of the Muslim world. Particularly in Nigeria, for instance, where the Catholic Church is being persecuted. To have an Indonesian government receive them, the popes are warmly, and the Pope encouraging dialogue between religions. This is all to the good, because the model of tolerance in Indonesia should be followed by other Islamic countries. And certainly the Catholic population there, while small, is influential. And the Catholic Church, wherever it establishes itself, is always appreciated by all people because of its educational, hospital, social welfare efforts, all that it does to promote human development in according to the Christian faith. So there's no necessary conflict between Islam and Christianity when both sides agree that we are going to respectfully disagree about doctrine, but on the other hand, embrace human love and what, you know, God commands us to do, love our neighbor.
Yeah. John Allen, Bob, said this week, this is no longer the periphery, a place like Indonesia. He claims we in the West are the periphery. There are literally 3% Catholics there. I mean, come on. Is this stretching the point a bit?
Well, yeah, in a way, yes, it is. But on the other hand, this is kind of a shrewd move. You know, John Paul II visited Indonesia, too, back in during his papacy. Mm-hmm. And that part of the world, it's long been said that outside of the Middle East and primarily the Gulf area, the Muslims in Southeast Asia and in the East generally tend to be less radical than the people that we hear the most about because they produce the most trouble in Africa and in the Middle East. So to go mm-hmm. there and to talk about the possibility of a harmonious coexistence, at least tolerance of one another, I think that that's all to the good. We all get a little nervous about this kind of conversation because it can, at least certain people can read this as the church being a bit submissive toward Islam. And of course, we're telling them about tolerance because it's mostly Islam that's persecuting Christians. It's not Christians perpetrating violence against Muslims. But I think overall to go there and to have a willing dialogue partner who's probably about as sincere a dialogue partner for peaceful coexistence as you can find in the Muslim world, that's not bad at all. I don't believe that the West is the periphery in terms of Christianity. I think we still have some fight left in us, but I'm glad that he's gone and brought the message. You know, when he's spoken to Christians there, he actually talked to them about taking risks for Christ and to listen to the one voice that can save us, and that is Jesus. So that, too, is to the good.
Hmm. Father, earlier this week, the Pope offered a final prayer at an interfaith meeting with young people. There was some reportage and disgruntlement that he did not make the sign of the cross, did not mention Jesus Christ. And he said, quote, "We are from different religions, but we have only one God." The people, a lot of folks online are saying he missed the opportunity to bear witness to the faith. Your take.
Well, the Pope did this before. Remember his first meeting with journalists after his election? He said, since there are non-believers here, I'm not going to give a blessing. I'm just going to hope that God helps you. It's a gesture that I wouldn't do that because I think Muslims and non-believers expect the Christian Pope, the Catholic Pope, to do what he does all the time, which is to make the sign of the cross over the people, invoke God's blessing. So, but on the other hand, you know, the sentiment the Pope is trying to convey to those people is that he loves them and appreciates them. And I would say that's good, but blessing them is a further sign of that. It's not a sign of anything else. So to love and show people respect includes bringing Christ's blessing upon them.
Yeah. This dialogue with Islam was something that John Paul, later Pope Benedict, really tried to initiate and move forward. And on Thursday, Pope Francis met with Jakarta's Grand Imam outside a mosque. Together, they vowed to stand against fundamentalism and protect the environment. They issued a joint statement calling for interfaith harmony and common cause. Bob, this mosque is very near the Church of the Assumption Cathedral, and the two structures are connected by what they call a tunnel of friendship. It's a passageway underneath. What do you make of that joint declaration, which has become a central theme of France's interfaith outreach?
Well, you know, scholars tend to debate the exact status of what Islam is to Christianity. Because, you know, when we look at Judaism, Judaism is the religion out of which Christianity comes. Jesus says, I haven't come to abolish the law, I've come to fulfill it. So we have a kind of a common heritage with the Jews. Islam is on the other side of things. It is kind of rejection of Christianity. It talks about Jesus being a prophet. It honors Mary in some places that I've encountered when I've been in Islamic countries. But it's a different kind of friendship. And I think we all feel a little bit of nervousness about this, nervousness about the theological status of it, and also because there has been so much recent violence perpetrated by Muslims. So, look, insofar as this is a step in, again, to say this tolerance, this live and let live attitude, that's a good thing at that level. But I think we know that there are other things that are going on, and if we can reproduce that type of connection between people of goodwill, then fine. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that there are also other factors involved in Islam these days, as well as a theological, just social conflicts that it's going to take a lot more than some dialogue to resolve.
Father, what do you make of the fact that the Pope often leads these interreligious conversations with the environment or the shared, you know, this idea of a shared humanity? That, as we said earlier, makes people a little nervous.
Well, the mission of the church is not, in the first place, to protect the environment. I mean, that is a derivative aspect of caring for creation. But remember, this world is passing. Our home is in heaven. The world to come will be the fulfillment of all human hope, and the life of heaven has to be the focus. So the other point, of course, is when you talk about environmentalism, it's not like there's one doctrine which says you have to do this in order to please God. You know, people who are against development will say, well, we can't tear down the forest and plant crops because it destroys the forest. And the other people say, wait a minute, if we don't plant crops, people are going to die. So that's where you get into the political debates about priorities and which things government should favor. So we all want a clean environment. The question is, do we want it imposed at the cost of socialism and government control? And certainly the church teaches that freedom and individual responsibility of citizens comes before government control.
Yeah. Father, I want to move on. Former Vatican spokesman, director of Toronto's World Youth Day in 2002, Father Thomas Rosica, has been charged with the sexual abuse of a priest, and the lawsuit was filed in March. The plaintiff, a yet unnamed priest from Canada, alleges that Father Rosica abused him while making preparations for World Youth Day. Father Jerry, I'll start with you on this because it's a canonical question. Rosica's denying any improper conduct, and he is the Canadian court has yet to rule on the suit. But Rosica's asking that the case be dismissed and that a church canonical review be allowed to proceed. Is that sufficient here?
Well, this is a civil suit, so it's alleging harm perpetrated by one individual on another. And it certainly should go forward because the man who files the claim has evidence and has presented a case and will argue it in court. The canonical case would be to examine whether he violated, is guilty of violating any canon law, particularly as regards vows of chastity or celibacy, whether he made use of, his influence as a priest to have, a position of imposing himself on this other person. A canonical process is completely separate. It doesn't depend on what happens in the civil process. So it should go ahead civilly, and then I hope his religious superiors are taking the steps for a canonical investigation, because if it's true that he committed sexual abuse against, I think this man was a priest or seminarian at the time, then this definitely has to be examined.
Bob, Father Rosica was previously involved in a plagiarism scandal that he admitted to in 2018. He became a Vatican spokesman earlier in 2013, was a media advisor at two synods of bishops. Your reaction to this story, Bob, and the allegations presented here?
Yeah, I think that this is very, very sad. Father Rosica was really a celebrity priest. I've actually talked to some priests who knew him in the early 2000s, and he was you know, he was called upon by very, very orthodox orders of nuns. He gave beautiful retreats. Everyone was happy with him. And it's about the same time that this alleged abuse took place. I'm sorry to see this. I don't know if we have to let the process play out. It's only fair to let there be witnesses presented and evidence examined. But I'm not entirely surprised at what happened. And it was probably wise on the Vatican's part that they removed him from a sensitive position on those synods when these sorts of things started to surface.
While we're talking of the synod, the upcoming synod on synodality is reconvening in October in Rome next month. There is an ongoing, gentlemen, Amazon synod, which met just weeks ago, which I'll bet most of our viewers probably never heard anything of. They discussed greater participation of women, as well as a, quote, Amazonian rite, and how that could be celebrated, a liturgical rite. Reports surfaced this week that the Amazon rite of Mass will enter a three-year experimental phase later this year, inspired and infused by local traditions and customs. Father, what have you heard about this new experimental rite? And when can we expect the Tridentine experimental rite? I can't wait.
Well, of course, this is the big question mark that hangs over this entire matter. We were told when the traditional Latin Mass was being put aside by the Holy See that there is only one expression of the Roman Rite, which is the Novus Ordo.
Right.
Well, that wasn't true then. It's not true now. We have the Anglican use. The Tridentine Mass absolutely is an expression of the Roman Rite. It's very ancient. But now the Holy See, which says the Tridentine Mass is not an expression of the Roman Rite, now they're saying the Amazonian Rite will be a variant of the Roman Rite. And what will the variations be? Undoubtedly, based on what I've seen, and the history of it, it'll be the incorporation of pagan ritual elements, which somehow will pay homage to the previous religion of Christians in the Amazon, their ancestors' religions. But this is wrong. We do not incorporate paganism into the Catholic Mass to try and show appreciation for something that we reject, which is we don't believe in pagan gods. We don't believe in pagan rituals. The mission of the Church is to preach Christ, not to embrace the errors of paganism and to pretend that somehow this is an act of respect. This is actually, it's a little bit like sociology being used as a tool to say to people, well, you know, we hope you feel good because your ancestors did this and now we're going to resurrect it. And then the people who are serious and very devout Catholics say, well, wait a minute. I'm glad my ancestors rejected that. We believe in Jesus. Yeah. We're happy that God sent the missionaries to us. You know, that's certainly. I'm Irish. I'm glad we don't, you know, do what the Irish did when they were pagans. We worship God now.
Yeah. Well, this would be like having, you know, a Zeus interlude in a Roman church. I mean, we don't do that. We don't need a Pachamama Rama here. But Bob, reports have noted that this new Amazonian rite might be similar to the Zaire rite in use in the Congo since 1988. How much enculturation can the Roman Catholic Mass bear and still remain a Catholic Mass? I'll ask both of you that.
Well, look, I think that the question of enculturation is an interesting one. And there is St. John Paul II actually said that a faith that does not become a culture is not really a living faith in a place. So there is room for adaptation. But as you rightly suggested, Raymond, what we saw during the Amazonian Synod was Pachamama. And then when that controversy erupted over it, we saw the Pope actually put a plant that was associated with the pagan gods on the altar at St. Peter's. Now, we keep hearing, as this new Amazonian rite is being discussed, that it's about things like using a ceramic bowl rather than a censer, you know, for incense during a mass and other things that are already being used in the Amazon. And so it's being presented as if it's just a kind of a minor nod to certain things that existed there already. But I have to say that I'm a little bit worried. The Amazonian Synod kind of left things up in the air about women. And it left things up in the air about the viri probati and about this rite. And so I'm a little bit worried that that kind of more radical acceptance that Father was talking about these pagan elements, has not entirely been exorcised from this whole process. And we'll have to see where it goes.
Okay, let's quickly talk about the aforementioned synod on synodality. I've got a minute. It starts in October. The working document calls for 10 working groups set up by the Pope. Once again, the role of women will be a central topic of discussion, as well as, quote, transparency and accountability. Father, very quickly, this notion of a female diaconate is once again up for discussion. Former Irish Prime Minister Mary McAleese accuses the Pope of undermining the Synod on Synodality by supposedly downplaying the role of women in decision making and by upholding the ban on ordination of women. Do you see the Pope as an obstacle to ordaining women? I mean, if anything, hasn't he kept the door open?
Well, he told CBS News no to women deacons, and he's also said no to women priests. But if that's the case, why is this stuff still on the agenda? So, now, Mary McAleese is an agent of change. She wants to radicalize the Catholic Church, so she's using this opportunity to try and poke the Pope in the ribs and say, get with it. The synod, though, is a shadow synod, because all the significant discussion was placed in those 10 groups you mentioned. Well, those are experts. Those aren't synodal members. And they're going to report to the synod and tell, you know, an interim report of what they're doing. But their report is coming next June at the earliest. So this synod is essentially going to be like a parliament where you invite civilians in to listen to the experts, and then they walk out. They don't have any real power. The experts have all the power. So I'm saying to myself, the synod started as the expression of the people of God coming together with the pastors. And in the end, it's going to be like most European bureaucracies. The experts will produce a piece of paper, tell us to sign it, and then to be happy.
Bob, what do you think the synod means when it talks about transparency and accountability? I mean, all this seems very vague. I guess Vatican diplomacy is immune from this, given the Vatican-China Accord, which still remains a secret and less than transparent. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, look, I think Mary McAleese is expressing something that we worried about, years ago as this whole process began. And that is, there was a sort of invitation for people who are on the progressive side to lobby the church on issues that have been examined and decided over and over again in favor of the tradition. So maybe this was a way that the Holy Father thought he could bring both wings of the church together, and there would be a discussion, and people would at least come to respect one another. But what it did is it did give the impression, I think, to not only her, but to lots of other people, that everything was up for grabs. And little by little, it became clear that it wasn't, that there wouldn't be women deacons, and there wouldn't be this valuing, so to speak, of homosexual relationships, although we're going to see when those 10 study groups. It's interesting that we've had these two, and that we will have had two month-long sessions, and we're still going to need 10 study groups to deal with some of the hot-button issues and a lot of sort of inside Catholicism, structural, institutional stuff. So it's a confused situation, but it did give. Insofar as there was transparency, it did give people the impression that everything was up for grabs, and now we'll see where it all cashes out.
Gentlemen, we will leave it there for commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray. You can go to thecatholicthing.org. Thank you, gents. Believe it or not, I am not in Capernaum. This is Midlothian, Texas. It's the set of The Chosen. And this global phenomena has attracted 700 million viewers. It's now in its fifth season. I'm here on the set of The Chosen. We're going to talk to Jonathan Rumi, the star of the show. I sat down with him recently to talk about the show and how it's affected his life. This is such a huge role. Yeah. You know, the character arc is pretty flat. I mean, he comes perfect, he ends perfect. There's not a lot of variations, but getting inside Jesus Christ is, I mean, and there's only a handful of guys who I think have ever mastered it, really, and yeah. You would be among them.
Thank you.
What was the biggest challenge when you came to that, to the realization? Let's go back. I just remembered, I saw you years ago in a Faustina production.
Oh, you saw that.
So I saw the first
11 years
Jesus.
Ago. Wow.
Yes.
The first
I saw Jonathan Rumi's first appearance as Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the very first time I played Jesus at all. I was still I wasn't quite settled in the accent yet, but I knew that that was what I was going to do, was a Middle Eastern accent based on my family members, certain family members. And that was 3 days up in Washington State with a teleprompter. So it wasn't quite the ideal performance that I would have wanted to give, but it was kind of those, like, we've got 3 days. There's no way you can memorize all this because we're just giving it to you now. Just read the teleprompter and do your best. I'm like, okay. And I had a wig and the whole thing. Yeah, but it was still, for me, because of the story, because of Divine Mercy and my connection to Divine Mercy, which is actually what got me the job, I think, in reality, because of my connection to Divine Mercy, it didn't matter. Like, I was like, okay, it's not ideal, but I love getting the opportunity to play our Lord.
So that was it, and he was ready to play you.
And then six months later, I met Dallas Jenkins for our first short film for his church as Jesus.
Amazing. And you were, at this point, you were at a very low point in your career. I mean, you say you were down to your last $20. How did Divine Mercy change your career and your fortunes?
At that point, when I did that, I still wasn't, making a living as an actor, but I was supporting myself at that point a little better than I was by the time my deeper conversion happened, which was about 4.5 years later. So I wasn't completely broke yet, but I was just getting to know the L.A. scene, trying to meet casting directors. I was booking some TV shows. I think I did an episode of Castle and Parenthood and right around that time, and doing a lot of voiceover work, which was kind of my mainstay. But I was also, balancing out with other jobs.
Why do you think Dallas came to you for that role?
Well, I read for... So the story was about the two thieves. Yeah. It was originally titled Once We Were Slaves, and then they changed it to The Two Thieves. And I read for one of the thieves. I read for the penitent thief, which my buddy Stelio Savant ended up booking. And he ended up playing Moses in the Chosen series, I think, in the first or second season. So I really was invested in telling that story. And then I got a call back to read for Jesus. And I thought, oh, man, that means I didn't get the other one. Mm. It wasn't a sure thing for the other one. And I said, well, I just done the Faustina project 6 months before. I said, I love me some Jesus. If I get to play him again and get a chance to work for a couple of days in this on the short film in Chicago, then that'd be great. And, the story goes, he said he knew within 10 seconds that I was the Jesus that he wanted to use.
How did you initially prepare? And I've been meaning to ask you this for a long time. Were you trained as an actor? Did you have a technique that you favored?
I do. Yeah, I did. I was trained as an actor. I didn't go to a drama school. I worked mostly in behind the scenes for most of my career up until that point that I went out to L.A. I had been for about, before Dallas, I had worked for about 12 years, no, about 14 years in production. And I was a production assistant. I was my longest stint was as a location scout and a location manager in New York City, and then I was doing voiceover. And that transitioned to like on camera commercials, and then some bit parts in TV shows. Then I moved to LA, and then started from scratch, just focusing on acting. But before, probably the mid 2000s, as I was realizing that I didn't want to continue on the production train, I wanted to get training. I wanted to know. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to just get jobs by happenstance or because I kind of was, ripe for it, or that I knew enough to be able to book a job, but I wanted to have a firm technique that I could survive on. And so I trained in Eric Morris's system.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, basically a guy that combined a number of different method-based systems together to create like one of the most comprehensive acting systems anybody could ever study, which I use still to this day.
You still use that to prepare for the... How did you apply that to this role? I mean, to the challenges.
Yeah.
You don't have the raw stuff that other, you can base it on somebody, you can build a role on a historic figure.
I can't watch video exactly.
No, there's no YouTube of Jesus.
There's no YouTube of Jesus.
Well, there is now on The Chosen, but before there was.
For me, it kind of stems back to the challenges of playing Jesus to begin with. Like, well, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. Robert Powell once in an interview said, to try to tackle the character of Jesus. I mean, he's unplayable. Like, he's impossible to play. Mm-hmm. So, none of us know what it's like to be divine. We do know what it's like to be human. So the thing that I do is to bring the utmost of my humanity to the role as Jesus, and then let the Lord and the Holy Spirit sort out the divinity aspects of it. And so when there are moments in the story in The Chosen where we see Jesus, the fullness of his humanity, or he's having, you know, he's experiencing what he would have experienced as a human being, I can only bring my own emotional life to that. And if it's not something that happens just out of, you know, the result of the exchange of dialogue with myself and my colleague, then I have to find a way to stimulate whatever emotion that I think the scene obligates. Mm. And then I'll go into my toolbox, and often that stems with sense memory as one of the most fundamental aspects of the method.
You said something, the more you count on God, the deeper he takes you. Where has he taken you in this role?
Oh, I think he's taken me closer to the heart of Jesus. He's taken me to the essence of servanthood and servitude and surrender, really. That has been the heartbeat of my aspirations towards holiness, is complete and utter surrender, you know, with everything I can, everything I think I can control, but of course everything I cannot control. I have to offer it up to him and just say, you know, even filming these last 2 weeks, the two of the most difficult scenes for me, for the entire series and possibly of my career, is wrapping my head around how to communicate what actually happened at the Last Supper in a way that people feel that, as opposed to merely just hearing the words in Scripture, but feel what it is that he meant. And not knowing what exactly that looked like. So the only option I have, whether it's that or it's in the Garden of Gethsemane where he's sweating drops like blood or blood, depending on the translation you read, what generated that? What did that feel like? I have no idea. So I have to surrender that moment and say, God, you have to direct my steps in these scenes because they're beyond my comprehension. They're beyond my ability to infer what you were feeling. Like, Lord only knows. But I'm here, I'm open, I'm a vessel. Use me the way you want people to experience these moments.
Jim Caviezel told me after playing, and while he was playing Jesus at one point, that he felt the profound loneliness of Jesus.
Yes.
What have you learned of him through playing? Actors learn, when you put other people's words and bodies over your own, you do come away with an understanding that frankly no one else has, I think. What have you come away with?
It's true. I think, I'll speak specifically, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and ultimately when we get to the point where there is the betrayal by Judas, because it's part of the story, the sorrow and the sadness and the devastation for Judas, because of Judas, anticipating the journey of his soul from that point forward, I think to me that became something where there was more empathy than I was ready for, but also extreme disappointment and sorrow and just devastation that he chose this path. And to see this moment where here he is, it's over, he's left it all behind. To me, it was devastating, and I was depressed for most of the time we were filming it.
Wow.
And I think it was on set, people didn't know how to react to me. I kind of felt it was like I was just shut down to everybody, which is great for the scene.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm also home. I also pray that everybody fully understands what that was and what that, why that was so pervasive.
So devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, the timing. And we were talking about this the other night. The timing, you were just shooting The Last Supper on The Chosen. At the same time, you were giving this incredible speech in front of 50,000 people at the Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. Tell me about that experience, that juxtaposition or maybe continuity between playing the establishment of the Eucharist, the gift of the Eucharist, and then going to this conference that's trying to revive belief and love in the Eucharist.
I mean, it just speaks to, you know, the accuracy and the beauty in God's timing and the intentionality behind His designs, because I committed to this almost a year ago, the Eucharistic revival, not knowing anything about our schedule. And then when we started in March, we got a schedule, and I'm like, so I'll have just finished the Last Supper scenes, and then I'm going to go speak at the Eucharistic Congress. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I see what you're doing.
Got the rehearsal again.
It never fails to just strike a sense of awe and wonder within me, and also just confirm everything that we know about God to be true, is that, I mean, he is who He says He is, and He lets you know if your eyes are open and your ears are attentive.
You are wearing the exact same T-shirt with one of my favorite quotes from one of my favorite Southern authors.
That's right.
If it's a symbol, to hell with it, which Flannery O'Connor famously said at a dinner party when they said, well, that Eucharistic thing, that's just a symbol.
Yeah.
When you walked out with that shirt, I said, everybody's going to want this shirt now.
Yeah, and that seems to be the case, so which is why I'm actually making it available. So
you are?
So you'll be able to have your very own official...
Where do you get them?
You can go to my website, www.jonathanroomy.com, and there'll be a link there to the store, the only store that's selling it. Because that night when I left the conference, people were already like, hey, I'm making these shirts if you want to get them. I'm like, there's knockoffs already. I gotta get in on this. I'm like, if people want the real thing, like, let me. And there's also scripture on the back. There's a passage of John on the back.
And what do you make of this Olympics we saw, the opening of the Olympics? So you've got Last Supper shot here, Eucharistic revival, and now an international display of the Last Supper in not quite the way I'll bet you all shot it here.
Yeah, it was a little bit different. We did it a little bit differently. I think we did it with the utmost attention and respect for the truth of what actually happened and the reverence of the meaning behind it, contrary to what we saw. Which, you know, if some people interpret it as not being representative of the Last Supper, I look at it, I'm like, well, the pictures match, the positions match.
The participants said they were replicating.
I just heard that today, and so I'm like, okay, well, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, quacks like a duck, I mean, it's probably a duck.
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing that is a distortion or anathema to God's truth will ever last. It is temporary. It is fleeting. It's a pot shot, if you ask me. And so in response, the Chosen and then myself reposted our image of what the Last Supper table is going to look like, and that's what it's about. It's about Jesus. Yeah. So I think it's kind of laughable. But it's unfortunate, too, because there were, like, children in the audience and just...
And at home around the world watching this.
It was pretty disappointing to see. But I think our response has to, you know, if not identify it, remind people of what is the truth, of who is, you know, the Lord of the universe and the King, and who should be the center of our lives, and it's Jesus.
Final question. It's obvious... The Chosen and Jesus are going to be a part of this career. And I imagine, even after you complete Resurrection and Season 7, you'll probably be making reappearances as time goes on, I would imagine,
That'd be fun.
Won't.
I hope so. That'd be
but
great.
What do you want to do next when this is over?
Man, well, even before this is over, I've got projects in the pipeline. I'm looks like I'm going to be doing a film abroad, romantic comedy, which I'm really excited about.
Fun.
More details to come on that. Okay. I love comedies. I don't get to exercise those muscles as much as I'd like. Obviously, with Jesus' story, you're limited to what you can do, but we kind of throw them in here and there, and I'd love to really tackle a comedy. I love sci-fi fantasy, you know. I'm a Dune fan. I'm a Star Wars fan. I'm an Indiana Jones fan. Like, I ride horses. I can crack a whip now. So, I've got some tools in the tool belt that I'm looking to use in for other stories.
Great.
Sci-fi is another genre that I'd love to tackle. So, yeah, I'd love to try a whole lot of things. And I think that at the end of the day, as long as the stories are good and there's a moral center to them, I will be attracted to those stories. If they're kind of fruitless and lacking substance and consequence, then it probably wouldn't interest me.
All right. Jonathan, thank you for
Raymond.
The time. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure,
thank
my
you.
Friend. God bless you.
God bless you.
Jonathan Rumi stars as Jesus in The Chosen. For more information on how you can watch or stream the series, visit thechosen.tv.
Finally, the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion nationwide was overturned 2 years ago. Democrat nominee Vice President Kamala Harris is the first candidate to run vigorously on abortion rights. Now, states can decide for themselves the legality of abortion. But what will the future of the pro-life cause be after a new president takes office? And why is there such division in the ranks of the pro-life movement months before this election? Here with answers, pro-life leader and the president of SBA Pro-Life America, Marjorie Dannenfelser. Marjorie, thank you for being here. The Trump position on abortion has really come under fire by some in the pro-life community, from the removal of the GOP pro-life plank in the platform to the former president's support and now endorsement of IVF. President Trump did announce that he would vote no on Florida's controversial all-trimester abortion amendment that would force Florida taxpayers to fund abortion, eliminate parental rights, and virtually allow abortion throughout pregnancy. Marjorie, what do you make of the overall Trump position on life, and how does it compare, in your estimation, to the Harris campaign?
Well, I can't say that I like any of the things that you just mentioned, except for the fact that he's voting against that amendment. Of course, any pro-lifer would not like to hear some of the things that have happened. However, I think it is a symptom of a lot of leadership in disarray in the Republican Party, and a concern and a desire to have a little bit of more space and time to try to figure out what direction. That's not leadership. I'm not giving any excuses. I'm just saying that is the reality. What he is doing is he is committed to protecting states' ability to express their own moral convictions on the abortion issue in the laws of those states. What we have on the Harris-Walls side, however, is the most dramatically pro-abortion platform that you could possibly put together. And that is that every abortion, all trimester abortion, would be the law of the land of this country. They will stop the filibuster to do so. They even want to put that in the U.S. Constitution. They want to make sure that the courts are configured so that we never have this opportunity again. That is the definition of existential threat. So you just have to do a side-by-side and go with the one that you know would stop all of our efforts to save lives and serve women in ways that they deserve.
A well-known pro-life activist like Lila Rose of Live Action, who has a podcast on EWTN, she advocates for a federal ban on abortion and sees anything less as an abandonment of the cause. On a recent podcast, she said Donald Trump's throwing babies under the bus. Marjorie, your reaction to that, and is that what's happening here?
I think you have to look at this moment like you look at every other human rights movement that's been successful in this country that was incremental. We don't love incrementalism because it doesn't please us completely. It doesn't please anybody on the left or the right, pro-choice or pro-life. But what the Dobbs decision did do was allow us to form consensus. That consensus makes its way into the law, and we're in the public square. The best argument wins, and that's what becomes law. We cannot impose our will as much as I would like to pass a complete ban on abortion nationwide now, because the nation just wouldn't allow it to happen. We don't have the votes even close. We do have the votes for, say, 12 to 15 weeks. Again, doesn't please everybody, but I believe we would have it if there was a strong leadership at the top that actually articulated this. Every single state will have its own consensus, and there will be a consensus on the federal level. That's the way democracy works, and that's what the tools of the founders have helped us in every other human rights cause in our nation's history to protect human rights in the law.
Yeah, Lila Rose and others seem to be making the case that the Trump and Harris platforms on abortion are equivalent. Do you see them as being equivalent? And, I mean, would the pro-life movement be in better hands under a Harris administration?
They're absolutely not the same. In fact, again, Trump's position, the Trump and Vance position, is to protect states' ability to pass laws that reflect the will of those people. We obviously are for national protections. This is not what he's running on. The Harris administration would wipe out every single pro-life protection in this country, all trimester abortions in the entire country, even after a baby is born alive. Even that baby you can't save. There simply is no comparison. And also the desire on the part of the Harris administration, if it were one, to reconfigure the courts, to make sure that no Dobbs-type decision ever came down again, that they reverse Roe. It's simply not comparable, despite some of the words that have come out of Trump's mouth that nobody likes.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion out there. And look, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is my email box has been full of people saying, what does this mean? I'm confused by this. Are they saying I should vote this way or that way? And look, you got to vote your conscience. I mean, that's what we should say up front. But, you know, Lila Rose has said publicly she would not vote for Trump unless he issues more public anti-abortion statements, pro-life statements. Do you think Catholics will simply sit this one out and not vote? And wouldn't that essentially give the election to Harris, who we know, as you mentioned, is avowedly pro-abortion throughout all stages of pregnancy? What happened to the lesser of two evils argument here?
I think that's what we do. That is what democracy is. That's what we've done every single election that I've ever cast a vote. There was nobody that was perfect. And there are a lot of people who were clearly not perfect, way less than perfect. But we have two people to choose from. One will lead to the death of children. This is not something that should be a waiting game till we get the perfect candidate. The other will preserve states' ability to pass laws that will save lives and serve women. It's a real obvious thing. And the perfect being the enemy of the good has been a great difficulty in the pro-life movement for many years. And because we have ideals, high ideals, but we are going to have to work for it. And we have to make sure that we're communicating with the candidates exactly what we think and what we expect of them always.
Yeah. Well, isn't this a case really of political ignorance? I mean, I see this kind of heart. I will not vote for this person until they do that. I mean, you don't have 100% majority you're working with, or even a 90 or 40 or, you know, percent majority.
Yeah.
You can't will a majority into being. And that, it seems to me, is the political naivete in all of this, Marjorie. There are some people who are demanding that politicians be more Catholic and more pro-life than members of the Catholic Church and leaders in the Catholic Church. So you're not going to get, they're not moral leaders. They're not spiritual leaders, boys and girls. These are elected officials. They reflect the will of your people. The problem is you had 5 decades to win the hearts and minds of your people, and you haven't done it. So I don't know how you expect a politician to sweep in and suddenly wave his hand and everybody converts overnight. There's a political calculus here, isn't there?
Oh, there is. I speak to Trump regularly. I speak to our Senate candidates regularly. I speak to members of Congress regularly. And the ones who are the most pro-life still understand that you cannot wave a magic wand and make the public believe what you believe. You have to convince them. And I'm very encouraged. Actually, after this election, there's a lot of these conversations that I'm having. There's a strong desire to work together in unison with one voice for the pro-life movement moving out of this election. I'm actually very encouraged. But what will be very discouraging and actually will disable our ability to make any advances is if pro-lifers stay home and allow the election of people who want to destroy the Dobbs decision, who will pass one bill that would wipe out every pro-life protection in the country and disallow any others coming up. That is disaster, and that can't happen.
Yeah. I have some news to share. Polling about the Catholic vote, and I'm going to share that in a minute, but what you've seen from the Biden-Harris administration when it comes to the treatment of those who are pro-life, Marjorie, is really, I mean, it has been onerous. Talk to us for a moment about the FACE Act and how that's been employed against peaceful pro-life protesters for the last 4 years. I mean, we read a story this week, an 89-year-old concentration camp survivor, this Eva Edel, who is facing 10 years in prison by the Biden DOJ for violating an act of peacefully protesting outside a Michigan abortion clinic.
It's the most explosive story that isn't told on networks, except for this beautiful one. It brings you to tears. Just a couple of miles away in the Alexandria jail, there are people sitting there who were peaceful. They're peaceful protesters, but they also found the remains of very late-term children, torn limb from limb, one in a partial birth abortion, very obviously. There were fully formed children, and these lovely people found and would not allow them to be desecrated. And then also they wanted to go the Department of Justice to go after break some law breakage with a partial birth abortion ban. They used they've used that also to imprison those people who rescued those sad babies. They call them the DC Five. It's such a tragedy. And yes, across the country, it really is a militaristic state that we're headed towards. If peaceful protest people just praying out in front of pregnancy centers are carried off to jail for their just exercising their First Amendment freedoms.
Marjorie, before I get to this new polling, for decades your movement wanted abortion policy returned to the states. It was the Trump administration that made the repeal of Roe v. Wade possible. Now abortion's been sent back to the states, as we talked about earlier. But why do you think, why are members of the pro-life movement now urging its return to the federal level, a federal ban? Why?
Well, we've voted. Well, the Kavanaugh's opinion, his concurring opinion, said this is going back to the will of the people, to legislatures, including the Congress. So I actually believe that it's important for there to be a federal minimum standard, that California can't go beyond, that Illinois can't go beyond, New York can't go beyond. It shouldn't be that the rights of California babies are nil and the rights of Alabama babies are 100%. So there is definitely a foundation and a standing, and there's a 14th Amendment that allows a federal legislation in this area, and many, many members of Congress and the Trump administration supported a 20-week limit before Dobbs. It's the same country we're living in now. And I think that we are working towards that. But the blowback after Dobbs made it very difficult to build. I think we will get there and we'll make it as strong as we possibly can.
Yeah. No, I hear all of this sort of stamping around and complaining by some leaders in the pro-life movement. But look, I see this as a failure of the pro-life movement and the Catholic leadership, to be perfectly frank. You had all these years to convert these people, to move them, to convince them, to open their eyes to the beauty, the preciousness, and the sanctity of life. You didn't stick the landing. Now you want a politician to come in and do your job overnight. Guess what? It won't work. It's not going to work that way. So I think there needs to be a deep reappraisal of all this because, again, politicians react to the voters before them. And these voters are telling them it's a pro-choice nation. Okay? Now, here's the real horror of this. This is an EWTN Real Clear Opinion Research poll that's just released today. And there was a collaboration here. The survey revealed that Catholic U.S. voters, okay, they are, and this was an August survey, it covered 1,000 voters between late August, the 28th to the 30th. By 50%, Catholic voters plan to support Kamala Harris for president. 43% support Donald Trump. 6% are undecided. When undecided voters are asked which candidate they lean toward, Marjorie, Harris's overall support increases to 54% to Trump's 45%. Perhaps the starkest statistic in the survey is this one. Female Catholic voters support Harris over Trump 56% to 37%. While male Catholic voters break for Trump 49 to 43%. Your appraisal of what that is, that's a 19-point difference among Catholic women. Catholic women. What's happening here, Marjorie?
Well, you've made the case very forcefully, and you're right that we have a lot of work to do. One of those pieces of work that has to be accomplished is the communication of the reality of abortion and actually what abortion is allowed in this country. Most people, their understanding, and I think that leads to polling results that are skewed because people don't understand what the reality is. The reality is in this country, if you're in California, Illinois, you can have abortion up until the end. Absolutely. But people don't know that. And it is a failure of Republican elected officials to not communicate that. I think it leads to people thinking, continuing to think, including Catholic women who are not looking at this. They think that abortion is just legal in the first trimester. That was the understanding about what Roe was. And that is a serious misunderstanding because that's not the case. I think that when you communicate, when you speak into those populations, Catholic populations and any population, about what the debate is really about, it's not about a national ban. Right now, where the discussion is about whether there should be any limit whatsoever in any state or on the federal level. The more particular you get, the better the results are. That's what we've found in all of our polling in every demographic.
We see it in Europe as well, Marjorie. I mean, they have 15-week abortions on, abortion bans. I don't know why that's such a big lift here in America. But look, given the tight race, what's at stake? Which party, in your opinion, is closer to the pro-life position and more supportive of crisis pregnancy centers who do the actual hard work on the front lines that, they don't just sit around issuing statements and getting clicks. Pro-life organizations lobbying on the state and federal level like yours and backing protesters' freedom to allow their voices to be heard on this pressing issue. Mm-hmm. Which party at this point would you say would protect those rights going forward?
Oh, well, There's no question that the Republican Party has embraced this issue. And because it doesn't seem to fully, after Dobbs, do every single thing that we hope that should happen eventually, doesn't undermine that. It is still the pro-life party. We are literally, as you can see, our party is that party is still finding its voice. Still after this decision that really affects so many people in this country, they thought it was going to be easier. It's not. It is the strong pro-life party. When you compare it with the other, you know that it'd be disastrous to wipe out 24 states' pro-life laws with the election of Harris and Walz. And that is exactly what would happen. There's no question about where the vote should be.
Marjorie Dannenfelser, we will leave it there, but I tend to agree with you. I think this was a movement that wanted this change. They wanted it out of the federal hands, but they had no playbook for what they would do on the state level, nor the coordination. And it seems the abortion side of the ledger had a playbook that they're implementing with great effectiveness, apparently. For more on the work of SBA Pro-Life America, visit sbaprolife.org. I'll give you the last word, Marjorie.
Yeah, they're on offense. We're on defense. There's no question about it. But there is also no question this movement never goes away. Our best laid plans perhaps didn't go exactly as we wanted. But there is, with every single life that is on the line, it is worth fighting for every single one. And there is no quitting. This election has to go pro-life.
Marjorie, we'll leave it there. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. We'll take a look at the great new film, God's Not Dead, In God We Trust, starring Scott Baio, David White, and a cameo by a certain TV host you might know.
Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.